Do you hear that, Ishan?
Oh.
Oh, wait, no.
Man, we have not.
No. We don't have that.
Live for the Mundangerous graduation ceremony in New York City, I'm your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Ishan.
And welcome to episode 335 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours. This is the debrief episode for Actual Play Season 3.
In this episode, we are discussing our playthrough of the 5th edition D&D adventure, The Magister's Masquerade, from the source book Strixhaven, A Curriculum of Chaos. We'll talk about what we liked, what we changed, what we would do differently, and of course, most important, how did we screw up in so many ways? So hopefully maybe you don't.
I imagine our first screw up came pretty early.
And maybe picking the adventure. We'll get to that.
Whatever.
We'll get to that. So starting next week, we are back to regular episodes and in general, the regular format. So let's jump right in. Shane, I don't think we expected that this AP would be 15 episodes, like a full Soulless Citadel. Yeah, I know.
We never do.
I always forget that each episode is 1 hour, right? So it's like four episodes for one session at a table. Mm-hmm. Or, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking of like in college, right? These days, we're like if we get 2.5 hours for a session.
It's interesting because on one hand, there's only two of us. So it's like, oh, well, we control the pacing. Like, we don't have to negotiate with 2 to 3 to 5 other people on how the session itself is paced. But the problem with that is you and I control the pacing.
Right. We should know us. We literally spent 45 minutes figuring out how Tez was going to open a door. And honestly, I enjoyed that episode a lot.
Was that your favorite moment, Isha?
Not my most favorite moment. It was up there, and only in retrospect, I was like, "Oh, we spent the whole episode figuring out exactly how Tez opens this door." Which, of course, we've talked about before, is not something that you can do at a regular table, of course, because you need to share spotlight, and everybody will hate the rogue if that happens, right? But there are very specialized kinds of games where you can do this, play by post or a solo game, and. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it because we got to get very granular and nitpicky and like delve into like the personality of like what does it look like when Tez breaks in somewhere, you know?
I'm guessing that was probably a close second for both of us then. So what was actually your favorite moment?
Maybe this is cheating a little bit. It wasn't necessarily a particular moment from this adventure. It was the interaction between Tez and the sidekicks, Scalabro and Meepo. And I think that's because this is the first AP where they've all actually sort of been like, they've come into their own and they have full-blown personalities, right? Because like Sunless Citadel, Scalabro didn't even really exist.
Right.
And then last time, it was the first time Scalabro and Meepo interacted. And like AP number two was, I think, a lot more like investigation-oriented. So we did discover a lot about those sidekick characters, but... this was the first time where they went in and we knew in a lot of ways who they were. And then in this series, we got to see sort of like moments of awesome and moments of shame for both of them. And then like interactions between them and interactions with them and Tez that weren't necessarily like, let's discover more about their personality. Although there were some of those, it was just like, we know how this banter is going to go. Let's just have some fun banter, you know?
I agree. I enjoyed those moments in the edited version of the show. I guess to peel back the curtain a little bit, some of that stuff was very hard for us to record because it ended up being a conversation between Ishan's NPC and a sidekick voiced by Ishan. So some of those conversations were me deciding what, you know, my party member would say, and then Ishan
and
having to record
it. Right.
Exactly. And then poor Aram having to stitch it all together.
Right. And I think like that is the thing that I still don't have a solve for. Actually, like this adventure aside, and APs aside, actually, like we sort of ran into this in Morning Glory sometimes where, you know, you had like a party NPC with you, right? And then you might meet other NPCs on your travels and the party interacts with them, but sometimes the NPC needs to interact with them and now I'm talking to myself.
Right.
And I still haven't really figured out a good way to get around that. And maybe it's just like, you know, share more fully the like actual control, like the puppeteering of an NPC, that might solve it.
Yeah. And I mean, the other piece that we used a little bit in like the epilogue, right, was rather than dedicating screen time to the conversation between two of your NPCs, it was a conversation between Tez and one of your NPCs about what they had just talked about.
Right.
So, you know, and that's just like kind of a like creative camera cutting, I suppose.
All right. So what was your favorite moment from this actual play?
So I don't want to brush over the rogue moments because I really did enjoy some of the rogue moments, though I very much hated the invisible stalker fight.
You should. That
like so with that brief interlude of just being an extremely unfair fight, an unfun fight, you know, like all of the rogue moments that kind of wrapped around that. But were great. But all of that to me led to my favorite moment, which was the party in front of the mirror and figuring out what it did. On one hand, because I wasn't really sure the role of the mirror in the story at all. It was showing us very strange things. And then as soon as Meepo got all of his stats fixed, I went, oh, that's what the mirror was
right,
for.
Right.
Cool. Because for multiple episodes now, we have been, or multiple seasons of the actual play, I have been frustrated by Meepo, the sidekick, having absolutely the wrong stats for what is thematically should be a kobold sorcerer who can't cast spells and can't do anything koboldish. Like, what have we been doing?
Right. Like you as a player were punished for making a good RP choice by saying, hey, this kobold should be a sorcerer.
Right. And then we grew his personality around him being like this kind of charismatic Lothario, you know, like silk shirts and open, you know, unbuttoned to his navel, kind of like, you know, hitting on like study abroad tourists.
Well, my question now is, does Meepo have a navel?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to figure out if kobolds are mammals.
Someone draw Meepo with an AI prompt and let's just see if it gives him a belly button.
But so I'm happy that that got fixed. But I also like, I thought it was very cool to see this sort of semi-prophetic, semi, you know, insightful kind of view into each of the characters and their desires.
That makes me happy. Let's talk a second for the layers of that moment. Number one, not in the adventure in any way. Whole made up out of whole cloth. And you're right. Like the entire reason it's in there is to give an in fiction, in world reason to fix Meepo's stats because they suck so bad.
Okay, so it wasn't there just to elicit some Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone references?
I can't say that there wasn't subconscious plagiarism, right?
Because
like we're in a magical dean's office, and I was like, okay, this is a good place to do it at this point in the narrative. What would be here? But it needed to be something that could involve you, like Tez and Scalabro as well, as part of the narrative. So it's not just so very obviously like, here's the thing that happens to Meepo, you know? And then we can like push the narrative forward and the characterization forward of like the rest of you. But okay, I'm glad that it like worked for you as a player, wholly improvised on the spot. But just so you, Babblecheek Bellegarde, Bellegarde was the name of the gnome, like artist who made the mirror, right? If you Google the phrase gnome names, there the first result that comes up is an alphabetical list of gnome names, and the first two are Babblecheek and Bellegarde, which I pulled up on the fly while you were like, who's the artist? I was like, God damn it. I don't know. Hold on.
You can't give me an artifact like that. and not expect the archaeologist to ask who made it.
I know. Well, I, you know, it, on the fly, you were like, what's a thing I can tell? I was like, artist stamp. Crap. So there you have it. And if you ever ask me the name of another gnome, it'll be the next two.
The next two, right? Yeah.
Or seven, the next seven, right?
Well, the next two are going to be Benedict Cumberbatch. I can't wait to meet him.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the changes from the book. Because, you know, if you're listening to this, there's a possibility that you might want to run this adventure. And the question we'll answer at the end of this, like we do with all these debriefs, is, you know, would we play this again and should you run this adventure? So for the first third of this AP, like the first seven episodes or so, they're actually pretty by the book. And then I think you and I had a conversation about like, hey, we're running this really by the book and we're seven episodes in. And at this rate, it's going to be 25 episodes and we can't do that.
Yeah. And also the book doesn't really give you much, like it didn't give us much to do that wasn't just repeating the same stuff. Right.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, like, I mean, we can talk a bit more about this when we get to like what didn't work, but this book has an adventure in it and it is most of the page count is the adventure, but it's not really useful as a plot driven adventure. If you want to do magical school, that is what it does. I think it will do it well, but that is all that it really does. It's scaffolding for the relationships and the interactions between the PCs and the other students at the school. But if you want like a dungeon crawl or a mystery or whatever, that is not what this is, because there are huge chunks of the narrative that are like, and now free role play your interactions in this scene. But like, that's a session or two, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think when I was reading this initially, I was like, oh, we could finish this. No, we could not finish it as written.
And the other problem is that like the way that we have kind of structured the actual play is we don't skip over the like silly details, like the human moments, if you will, of like meeting people, right? Like, you know, we say, oh, how are you doing? And, you know, like, what do you do? And how's your family? And like, you know, like those kind of like that seemingly small talk that like never happens at a table with six people.
Right. Right? We spent 30 minutes with the kind of racist inn owner and Sunless Citadel, right? Like before Karen. You even got on the, yeah, exactly. Before you even got on the road.
Yeah. The longer that I spend talking to somebody, the more important they become, because right. You just shove more and more plot points into that conversation.
Right. It's got to come from somewhere. The mayor has nothing to tell you anymore.
Right.
There are a lot of random encounters, like random encounter tables in this adventure. Basically dropped those because they were completely unimportant to the plot and we really needed to like be plot forward.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously the like biggest change that you made was Strixhaven became Arcanics, right? So, but I believe that all of the layout and like physical description and all of that stuff is the Strixhaven description, not anything from like Eberron's canon of what like Arcanics actually is, right?
For the most part, yeah. Like, you know, part of the
Arcanics is a real place in Eberron, like that. Right. Like it's a known location. It's a thing.
Right, and it's in source books. You know, you can like go look up Arcanics and has stats and all that kind of stuff. Right. And of course, part of the reason that we're running adventures in the first place is so I don't need to create everything out of like an entire adventure out of whole cloth. So anytime that I can read from the box text, I will happily do that. And so I did. The only real change is Arcanics canonically is floating towers, and Strixhaven is like a massive sprawling campus where like it's a different page for every school, like a page in a book for every school. So you can wander around like these huge like campuses and quads and all that. And I was just like, it's non-Euclidean that you do that too. It's just in the air. And then when you're not there, they're not there.
You know? Sure.
Yeah.
Great.
And then Arcanics canonically is like the whole you open a door and it goes wherever, and there are interdimensional spaces and blah, blah, blah. So it was easy enough to like just shorten Strixhaven to wherever it needed to go.
Got it.
We swapped out the non-Eberronian races. Strixhaven uses, like the Strixhaven book uses fantasy races from a lot of newer source books from D&D, like Javanish is an owlin, which is like, you know, an owl person. And so I just did like a swap for something that kind of fit, like, you know, fantasy races fit in different boxes, right? So just someone in the same box. It was like, okay, he flies. So how about Swiftwing Shifter? Done. Rampart was a Loxodon, I think, an elephant person, which I don't know, they can exist in Eberron, but I don't want to have to figure out where they exist in Eberron. Yeah. So like Goliath it was. And then this is a conversation like that the two of us had. One thing I actually liked, so we'll talk about that a little later, is there's a long list of NPC students, like other students that you interact with, which was extremely helpful. But one of the characters is Nora Ann Wu, who the box text says she's an RA in the dormitories and offers confidential support to any student and is especially passionate about counseling other transgender students. So that's the only like sort of notification in the text that tells you that Nora is trans. But in that same breath, it tells you that probably that is tied to needing counseling. You know what I mean? And like I initially read this in the introduction when we were recording it, just like, you know, from the text. And then after we were done recording, you and I were talking about it. And I think you were like, like, why was that the characterization of the trans student? And I went back and I was like, oh, I just read it off the thing. And then both of us were like, oh, I don't think that necessarily sits well with us. So I don't remember if we, like, just deleted that section about the counseling or if we, like, rearranged it so it was she's passionate, she's an RA and is passionate about counseling and, like, heads the transgender student union, you know?
Right.
So like they weren't tied together.
Yeah. I think I recall that striking us as kind of like a weird choice that like everything in this place is magical and happy except for that.
Right.
Right. Like nobody has any of the like, you know, like typical earthly struggles except for like, that one group of students, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was right. just a weird kind of the only thing they can be is victims kind of characterization.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other big change from the book is obviously like spoilers for the book. The villain is a bullywug.
Again?
Yeah. I know. Here's
the thing. Two bullywugs in a row?
Look, that's one reason I couldn't even like run it as is because I just introduced a bullywug, right? But it's a bullywug who is an evil mage who used to be a student who unnaturally extended their life and has now returned to the school to enact their revenge. And I was just like, okay, this is extraordinarily derivative.
That's very painful.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So that didn't happen. It did give me an opportunity to bring in Golthias because I don't know. Maybe this is the time to talk about it. I don't know if it's obvious to you, Shane. It's probably obvious to some listeners. Like, we are kind of, sort of going through the Sunless Citadel adventure path from third edition, kind of, sort of. In that there isn't really a Sunless Citadel adventure path, but there was a series of adventures created for third edition that began with Sunless Citadel and then went to Forge of Fury that kind of are playing out along this route that have to do with Ashardalon and Golthias, etc.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that wasn't apparent to me until it was apparent to me.
Right. until, oh, it's Gul'thias. Here she is. Yeah.
Oh. Also, I will be honest. I didn't recall that Gul'thias was a lady.
She is not. Nope.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, in third edition, Gul'thias was a guy.
Also, Shardalon did not kill Gul'thias. And I, spoilers for, I don't know, a 25-year-old adventure path. Yeah. Who cares, right?
Narrow subsection of canon.
Right. Gul'thias is staked by a druid, Did, D-Y-D-D, I think. And like one of the conceits of the adventure path is like you pick one of your players and their character is a descendant of that druid. And it's just like, I don't want to have to make Tez, right, who is the only choice, be a descendant of this random druid, right?
Proud Gale, head to toe.
Yeah. And also, I think when we were doing Sunless Citadel, I wasn't planning on it actually like necessarily being a campaign that mm-hmm. we played more of. And I think I was just like, oh yeah, just Shardalon staked the vampire. That makes sense. And maybe I was just remembering it wrong, but like it's worked so far for the narrative. So like that's the way it is in this campaign.
Yeah, I mean, well, to go back, I mean, I think the canon of Sunless Citadel is that like the druid stakes Gul'thias, and then the stake itself is what grows into the Gul'thias tree
exactly.
in the bottom of the citadel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think in my mind that's what happened anyway. And I've just been wrong about our own late canon just because that's what I recalled. But yeah, it's been a long time.
Well, if you're one of like the seven people who actually continued playing that adventure path, eventually Gul'thias does come back because destroying the tree does release his spirit.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And then I think you meet and fight Gul'thias in Heart of Nightfang Spire, which I've not played, but I've heard is just an awful, awful dungeon crawl that no one has any fun playing. So we didn't and we won't.
It's got a good name, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
maybe it will return. What is the real Heart of Nightfang Spire? It lives within you. It doesn't. Actually, the Heart of Nightfang Spire is a Shardalon's literal, physical, actual heart that he tore out of his chest, and it has been turned into a big dungeon with like chambers, get it? At the top of like a very tall spire, and you have to climb up the stupid thing and hack your way in and fight, 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 fight.
Well, it has a really cool name.
Yep. Agree. Turns out it was Shatterspike. That's the Heart of Nightfang Spire.
That's right, exactly.
Can I say, actually, I do love that on the Discord server, listeners have been ragging on us for getting rid of Shatterspike, given that in this campaign, there was a moment where you were like, how do I destroy magic items?
Exactly. Multiple people were kind enough to point out the irony, which was completely lost on me right. in that moment.
Which and I feel like Tez also would not remember his own failure, right?
Well, I mean, in context, right? Like we're months removed from these two things, and Tez finding minor magical items and fencing them is not like that's just par for the course, right? Like, oh, that one had a name. It was Shatterspike. What did it do? Who cares, right? What it did is got me 1,100 gold to pay my debts and pay my tuition and keep me, you know, one step ahead of my creditors.
Right, and not reminding you that maybe it could come in handy later is a great way for me to later reveal that someone in Eberron has a Shatterspike.
Has a Shatterspike, yeah.
All right, so let's move on to talk about highlights. Like, what worked, not necessarily from the adventure, but in this campaign, what worked for you?
There were a lot of characters, a lot of NPCs, and despite the large cast, I was able to sort of archetype them out and keep track of them. Mm-hmm. Right, like there's the goth girl and the cool kids and the jock and the this and the that, you know, the the newspaper nerd and the like gossip and like, right. Like you have all these kind of like high school, not real high school archetypes, but like, you know,
high school media movie archetypes.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, I couldn't always keep their names straight, but like my notes were literally like a name, usually like the, their race. So I would, you know, make sure that I called an elf, mm-hmm. and then like their high school media archetype. except for one. Well, actually, maybe this is it also fits the archetype, which is has a very punchable face.
Quintilius.
Yes.
The art does a great job of making him look extremely punchable. I'll agree here. Like the book has this deep well of personalities to pull from that. Like if I think about the, like the information that I queued up for myself to have on tap right before we were about to run every session, the first thing I opened up was the page with all of the different student personalities. Because I was either going to be introducing a new person or I was going to be referencing someone I had already introduced, and I needed like a refresher on like what extracurricular was it that they did, or like what was the, like what were the two personality points that they list. Like I think this is the absolute most valuable like three pages of this entire book, and it's very well done actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other piece of that I really thought worked was our framing device of Tez being undercover rather than an actual student, right? And that sort of tension between having a job to do and not getting too attached to what are, you know, adults, but effectively adult children, mm-hmm. right? And me as a player getting swept up in high school drama stuff versus like, you know, moments where Tez is like, I want to be the cool guy. And then other times where it's like, wait a minute, I don't even care about this. I'm leaving in like 3 months if I get this thing done.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I don't even go here. I was not even supposed to be here.
Exactly. So that's what, like, I enjoyed that kind of like natural tension, mm-hmm. Between our framing device and the adventure itself.
Yeah, I think that worked.
Which I think speaks to how, you know, immersive having that well of personalities was and like getting invested in all of their little bits and bobbles and dramas, you know?
Yeah, and I'll say this about it. Like one other good thing about this list of personalities is they're very well defined as people, but they, like the authors have left out all the things that are important to a character but do not need to be predefined. There's absolutely nothing in here about like which character has a tie to a different character or who might be in a relationship with whom or like what their sexual preferences are or not or any like anything like that. It's entirely available for you to define on your own, which makes each individual character so much more useful because they can be put anywhere that you want.
So Rosie Miffenbip isn't always in a clique with
No, not at all. I was when I was trying to decide who were going to be the ones who are like flanking Grayson and actually are not who they are, it was who are the most likable ones that I could twist, right? And Rosie seemed extremely likable, and it seemed like she would be the most fun like heel turn, right?
Right. The least likely to be errantly stabbed.
Right.
Then let's talk about what did not work in this adventure.
I
will start. The dual rules for somebody who brought several non-casters or uh-huh. several half-casters suck.
I gotta say, so I want Ted to say I understand what the author was going for when they're like, oh, it's a magical school and you can only use magic, blah blah blah. But it's a D&D game.
Right.
Right? And there's nothing in the book that says, make sure you pick a character that has magic. You can play like a stock non-magical fighter in this adventure. It's allowed. Right. It doesn't even warn you not to do it.
Right.
But then suddenly third year, you're like, oh, crap.
Right. I mean, unironically. I found my way around that by using the terrain to my advantage with just having Skelebro just hold somebody for a beating.
Right. I mean, that literally is why, as loot on the train on the way there, I gave you a wand of magic missile for him to use.
Which definitely turned out.
I mean, I like the solution that you came up with, but I was just like, he can't do anything, you know?
Yeah. And then the flip side is like, you know, I think it was Meepo was probably the most frustrating because he is a caster, mm-hmm. right? But he's hamstrung by the sidekick rules at that point still. Right. So I had to go find a way around the rules by digging through all of the spells I could, you know, possibly get through, which is just like unrealistic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's an unrealistic burden to put on a player that if you aren't like built for combat spell casting, that there's just a whole section. And that's like,
it was two sessions
and a defined encounter, right? Like, mm-hmm. page count dedicated to this. There's an actual map. Like, it's the kind of encounter you aren't supposed to skip.
Right.
So it's just, oh man, it's a bad choice. And it was a very frustrating couple sessions for me as a player. I very much felt like I brought a knife to a gunfight.
In fact, you cannot skip the dual encounter. You're basically like blackmailed into showing up if you refuse. There's no way to get around it.
Awesome.
Yeah. I think for us, the tension between Tez being in, like, getting wrapped up in, you know, college shenanigans versus knowing that he's here for like an important job worked. But in the fiction, Tez only did that for like 6 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the intention is that this lasts for an entire school year. And I kept thinking every time I was like reading one of these vignettes that goes back and forth between like, oh, here's what they get if they investigate the green mist that murders people. And then, okay, now we're, you know, building costumes. And I was just like, what party is going to be able to stay away from Dean Tullis for 9 months without wanting to investigate or like break into her office or whatever, right? Long before the adventure assumes that you're going to be doing that.
Right.
It's either that or like you're just not interested in the mystery as a whole and you just want to play magical school, right?
Well, that or like, I mean, I think there's a pretty good, a pretty realistic like point of view of like, my character is not going to go break into the dean's wing of the building and into their private office to rifle through their stuff. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, that's the only thing that kids are afraid of in high school media, right? Is getting kicked out of school.
And I think this is sort of another point where there's a little too much Harry Potter influence here, mm-hmm. where like, obviously each of these sections of these adventures are written to emulate a Harry Potter book, which takes place over the course of one school year, right? And the way that the Harry Potter book plays out, one, obviously it's not a narrative where you have, you know, four or five players going off in their own directions. And, you know, if you have one of them being like, I want to break into the dean's office, then you've got a problem, right? In the Harry Potter books, like, they get information and then they can't get any more information. And also, like, those kids are not particularly investigative, right? They don't mostly care or want to engage with that kind of stuff. But they hit barriers and then there's no more information. And then something bad happens 3 months later and then they get more information and that's it. And that is the way that you were supposed to kind of dole this stuff out. But it just feels unnatural to, I think, players who are used to Dungeons and Dragons.
Can we talk a little bit about the exam system that we briefly dabbled in before I said this is the dumbest thing we've ever done and I'm not doing it again?
I'm super interested in to hear your thoughts about the exam system because it was actually the time when I felt like, oh, these are actual rules and I can use these rules and like there's the right way and the wrong way to potentially do, like, to potentially take an exam, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, there's actually maybe even a little bit of strategy of like, do I pull an all-nighter or not? And like, take advantage or whatever, right? But okay, so yeah, what did you think of the exam? There are three. There are three, by the way, three exams in this adventure that you're supposed to take.
Pull an all-nighter decision is flavorful, right? Like, give you something to prepare. Fine. The exam itself, I enjoyed mostly because I cheated on it, or you know, cheated on behalf of Meepo.
Right. That I think that was probably the most fun part, is knowing that like the other two are probably going to fail, and so you are responsible for them.
Right.
It would have been less interesting. I mean, especially like the arcane history class, like you were specced for that.
Right.
Right. There's no way you weren't going to get two successes.
It's literally in my title.
Right.
Also, like, is an artificer. Like, come on.
Now, the other two exams weren't arcana and history. Like, right. They were different skills, but also just in general, you're kind of a skill monkey, right?
Very much. The rewards for the exams seem completely pointless, frankly. I think we maybe use the rewards once, right?
The, gives you the bonus dice, right? Yeah.
It gives you bonus dice on the skills you're already good at because you passed the exam. Mm-hmm. So great. How often do I need that? And really, like, for me as a player, what I got out of the exam was the notoriety of being top of the class, mm-hmm. right? And trying to use that to get access to the dean that was constantly missing, right? So right. It became a plot point way more than it became this like weird overlay system to skills that I'm already good at.
So this is an interesting question then. Was it frustrating to you as a player that every time you tried to engage with the dean, she kept slipping away or she wasn't available, or like you could
put so many like story fiat resources mm-hmm. into tracking her down, and it was extremely annoying that like I go to her TA, I go to her office, I send two people that are equally as false as I am and more powerful than me to find her, and they can't do anything, right? It's like I literally like have half of campus looking for this woman, and she just gives everyone the slip until she shows up the night of the masquerade. Like, come on.
Which is like there's nothing you can do with her until the final confrontation. There are a couple right. of like vignettes written in where like you confront her and oh, if you make a DC like 13 investigation check, you can tell something's up, right? But that's it. There's no way to engage further once you're like, oh, my suspicions are raised. Now I'm trying to press her. There's no information.
And like, what's weird to me about that is that like, you can solve for that by just inviting the players to her office, right? Like, and she's not there. So what do you do? Right? Like,
right, which is what we kind of ended up doing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We talked about above the table, like, going to the dean's office and doing all that investigation in the book happens right before the final confrontation.
Right. Oh, yeah. It happens amidst the final, like, it happens after she appears at the masquerade and after you chase her.
Yes.
It's like you chase her to her office.
And then you're supposed right. to, like, look around, fight the invisible stalker.
It's okay. So this part of the plotting is just insane to me, right? Because mm-hmm. you're frantically chasing her to try to save somebody. In our case, it was to prevent a prophecy, but I assume in the standard piece of the adventure, it's to, you know, do something equally important and urgent and
yeah,
timely.
Like sick in half the school, essentially. Yes.
Sure. So you are facing a timeline.
One would think.
But then the adventure writes it as it's like a video game where the NPC will just hang out indefinitely until you, you know, cross over the threshold and start the cutscene. Right. And so it's like, just, oh, take a long rest if you want. I don't care. Like, go through my whole office. Try to find me. Like, find all the backstory, whatever. Take 20, 30, 50 minutes, 2 hours. I don't care. I'll just be here waiting for a dramatic showdown with a kid.
It is literally that. I mean, Tez and friends did the logical in-world thing, which is they didn't search every room, right? But every room has stuff in it.
Right.
That is searchable. And actually, there are like little fights, like little like short random encounters, or like, you know, there are two like easily mowed over creatures in mm-hmm. each room. And I was just like, no, we're not doing that.
Man. So I think the way that we structured it made sense. But then again, like, I think the Houdini act that the Dean is playing constantly, like, mm-hmm. could have brought you into that information way earlier and way more interesting way, right? In you know, you probably need that. That's a bit of a carrot, right? But you probably need a bit of a stick to force you in the room. Because I do genuinely think, like, there's an element of, like, I don't want to get expelled for breaking into my teacher's office, right? But, like, you know, I think parties will get over that when they're on the threshold.
Right. And I think you do need to make it clear that, like, there's not really anything in here that's going to get you expelled. Like, you should be trying to push the envelope in terms of, like, what your characters do. Mm-hmm. Like, take risks and all of that, because...
Well, there's portraits on the wall, right? Were those animated living portraits in the adventure?
I believe they... Yeah. And actually, they're supposed to be, like, guardians, where if you don't have permission, they start dealing psychic damage to you.
Oh, well, you could easily just flip that to... They encourage you to go into the Dean's office because they're as baffled by her behavior as you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, and now you got in there and then a person with at least some type of authority has told you what to do. You're now, like, covered, right? So you could just advance the plot on your own. I fixed the adventure, Ishan.
I mean, if I was actually running this as a magical school game, I think you need a Dumbledore character. Right.
You definitely need an insurance policy. Yeah.
Like. Yeah. You need, like, someone on staff who, like, tells you, no, no, go do that. I can't do that because I'm too obvious, but you can do it. No one cares what kids do.
Right. Oh, don't worry. It'll all work out in the end.
Right. Try not to get murdered.
Right. All right. Well, you mentioned Dumbledore, so we might as well talk about this. How derivative all of this is.
I mean, yeah, he's the bad guy's just a Voldemort, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of Tom Riddle.
Yeah. And yeah, that's look, if you are buying this book not because you love Magic the Gathering so much that you want to play, like, there are other books where you can play Magic the Gathering in D&D, and those will be better for that, right? Mm-hmm. You're buying this book definitely because you want to play Hogwarts. And it'll do that, but I don't know, actually. Maybe it was a good decision on the part of the author to, like, make it so derivative, because this is what people are looking for if you have this book.
Sure. Does it feel like what you would think a Harry Potter game feels like?
No.
Given that you are limited to D&D's narrow window of play.
Well, and at the same time, you have a lot of D&D tropes in here as well, right? Like room by room searches of mm-hmm. a map with locked doors in between every room, and yep. monsters on either side that are waiting for you to come in, you know?
To kill you.
Yeah.
To kill you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it runs, it kind of jointly runs into this issue of, like, D&D's skill system is not robust enough or mm-hmm. meaningful enough or rewarding enough to engage with, that all of the various skills and sort of role play challenges within this adventure hang on their own, right? But neither does the adventure offer enough meaningful and rewarding combat to actually do the things that D&D does well.
Right. Actually, most of the combat in this would be the random encounters. Which are very random. You can easily get murdered in those random encounters or steamroll them.
Which strongly implies that several students are murdered by random encounters every single school
One
year.
One would think, like,
school
oh, we're
does
in the
nothing
swamp.
About it.
We're in the swamp gathering sticks. That's literally the task. And you can easily roll a blue slod who shows up or a hag. Well,
I hope that comes after the magical physiology's slotty exam.
I think there is a slotty exam, actually.
There is. There's very much a slotty exam, yes. It's level one, so.
Right. Actually, the reason that we did the third year and not the second year with me, like, changing, like, DCs and things like that, was I was reading it, and then I run into the magical skateboarding encounter, and I was just like, I can't run a skateboarding encounter. Like, I mean, I could run a skateboarding encounter, but not like as written, where it's like the magical equivalent of people yelling gnarly when you do well.
Yeah. Gross.
Yeah. So you were spared that.
Great.
Meepo doing a kickflip. But like with all the coolness of like a 90s cereal commercial, you know?
I mean, okay, I'm back. You got me back in.
Okay. It's a Capri Sun.
Right. It's a Sunny D commercial.
Meepo in a Sunny D commercial would be, oh my God, now we have to do Meepo doing commercials. Okay.
It would rule, yeah.
Wonderful. All right. So that then leads us to the question, what would we do differently if we had our druthers? Would you as a player do anything differently?
Are you asking me as a player and performer on an actual play, or are you asking me as a D&D player who, you know, is showing up to the table to play an adventure?
I think the latter, because that's probably more useful for listeners. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting tired of saying it, but like every time D&D decides to do one of these like super genre books, they just shouldn't. Right? Like D&D doesn't have to do that, because D&D doesn't do that, and that's okay for D&D. Right? Yeah. Like it doesn't have to be a universal joint. We can stop trying to like shove this stuff into it. And I understand.
Do not let
like,
Hasbro hear you say that.
I know.
It
I know.
It must and be
I,
universal.
I know. And I understand that like it's a real thing that there are, you know, groups that are never going to play anything but D&D. And so if you want to play this kind of adventure, the only way it's going to work is if you shoehorn it into D&D. Fine. I get it. That's not my situation. That's not everybody's situation. But like, there needs to be a strong warning on here that, hey, we shoehorn this into D&D, right? Like, this should be a Powered by the Apocalypse game, right?
Or, most likely, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, like this is a really good framework for Masks, right? Superhero high school or superhero college, great.
Right, you would reflavor the superpowers as magic spells.
Bingo, right? Uh-huh, oh, yeah. Cool. Now this makes sense, right? Like, but it doesn't make sense for D&D. Like, the all of the crap on my character sheet is useless here.
Yeah, like, essentially.
And right? I
Who
was
cares
a
about
caster.
Fear? Yeah.
Like, I took levels of Artificer, thank God. If I was just a rogue faking it through the whole time, like, it would be ridiculous.
I actually do now want to play where it's just, you know, all the numbers are the same, but you are a 13th level rogue with use magic device.
Yeah. and the equivalent of an Amex black card.
Right. What do I need all your ball bearings.
Exactly.
Why? Scroll of animate object. Oh, you murdered the whole school. Yes, I know. Yeah. I did.
What would you do differently? Because you were running this.
I mean, I'd probably run a different adventure for our purposes, right? Which is a solo game. Like, I would not want to run, you know, an entire campaign of like magical school with D&D rules, right? Mm-hmm. But if that is what you want to do and what you are looking for, I think this book works pretty well. It's going to give you the ingredients, but it does not give you a recipe in order to do it. But with like four or five people around a table who like have good rapport and sort of know what they want to get out of a magic school game, they can just do that. There's nothing here to hinder them from doing that. And it gives you enough of a framework where you can go from like vignette to vignette, and like we can linger on like the dance as much as we want and the preparation for the dance and all of that kind of stuff. And like, I guess in the background, there's a B plot of like someone trying to murder students, but who really cares, you know? But for I would run a different adventure.
Yeah. There's an... I'm going to try to say this as delicately as I can. And I'm not saying this with malice, but like, this is a D&D adventure for theater geeks who don't want to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Which is valid.
Fine. Yeah, exactly. But like, it isn't for D&D players who don't want to be theater geeks. I'll tell you that. Like, if you came here to roll dice and crunch numbers and, like, do dungeon crawly stuff, like...
Right, or have most of your sheet matter. Have, like, your background matter, right?
Right, play off of your character sheet. There's nothing here for you, right? Like, if you came to have a, you know, fun role-playing prompts and you know, like, do a lot of, like, improvisational kind of gameplay, there's something here for you. Like, I feel like it, there's certainly worse products on the market for that purpose, right? Like, this is fine. But boy, I pity, like, the, you know, the grognard who gets their hands on this adventure accidentally.
who gets roped into it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like.
Well, look, now I'm hoping there's at least, like, you know, one turf who just hates a year of their life playing this. I mean, now that you mention it, I think if there was one page near the beginning of this book that just said, hey, if what you really want is the relationships and the relationship building and the improv in this book, you can use all of this information. Just put the dice down. Don't ever roll anything. You don't need to make attack rolls. You don't need to make persuasion checks. None of that. Just RP all of this out and then use the relationship rules, like the very loose relationship rules where, like, you're either -2 or +2 or somewhere in between with everyone. And that tells you, you know, random bonuses about how much they'll help you or not, or how they'll react to you in a particular situation or whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, that is all the rules that you need for this kind of stuff. You don't need to make a dexterity acrobatics check to tell you how well you walk down the runway. Just RP it.
Right. There's, I also have like a bit of beef because I did go back and like skim through the book after we played, right? Mm-hmm. Like in between. So I do know what's kind of in here. And
was there anything you were like, oh man, I wanted that. We should have done that.
Yeah. You know, like I really wanted to roll a D6 to find out what snack I got at the Bozen Tavern.
Mm-hmm. You did roll a D6.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Oh, no, actually, I didn't make you roll. You got to pick. You picked what you wanted to eat. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. But like, so there's that. I don't know. Like, I got the impression that like, there's a lot of lift on the DM's part here.
There is.
Right. Yes. To make this work, like the DM has to do a lot. And like, you know, the personality list is and the character list is like great, right? For what it is, but it's 3 pages of like a full size, you know, mm-hmm. 150 page adventure. Right. Like you have to do a lot of filling in the blanks, right? Like you're paying a lot of money
for three pages
of do it yourself. Like I don't know, man. Like that's a tough sell for a product to me, like good or bad, you know, like that's a blog post.
Right. Right. It could have been a free download. Yes.
You know, I struggle with this as a product a lot, like I struggle with it as a $60 D&D adventure, right? I struggle with the content or the authors or some of the design, of course. But like, you know what I mean? Like paying $60 for this thing, oh boy.
Right. It's not a D&D adventure. It's not. I would love to hear from like Magic the Gathering players about like, was that enough of a draw? Like, was that useful enough? Because, like, I did a little research, right? I haven't played Magic in, like, decades, literally. But, like, Dean Augusta Tullis is a card, right?
Oh.
Reduced to Memory is a card, and that's the lore hold, like, special move, which is actually very good and does a ton of freaking damage.
I honestly forgot that this was a Magic tie-in.
I mean,
that explains a lot, though.
I mean, just do the Greek one. What was that? Mystic Isles of
Theros.
Theros. That's it. Theros of Theranos. And then in terms of other things that we might do differently, I think this would be very different if it wasn't a solo game, right? Like if the intention was the same, you were still like a rogue archaeologist and you're infiltrating or whatever for a prophecy or whatever, right? We're not actually playing magical school, but let's just say hypothetically, you know, for this one season, we had brought in other players. And actually, I had considered bringing in some home group folks to play some of these NPCs that I ended up NPCing, and it was just would have been too much like work and too much editing. But like, if we had decided that this season and only this season was going to be like a live stream with four players, I think that would have worked. It still would have needed to have been massively cut down because I think no way that people would have listened to the entire live stream as we like play out every single thing in this. Like, absolutely not. It would take a decade.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if one thing that I would probably do differently just from our setup and situation is like I probably would have taken direct control of Meepo and or Scalabro, so that we were able to play out the interactions between us a little more smoothly, instead of the Ishan talking to himself phenomenon. Mm. But that's, again, that's not the adventure's fault, right? Like, we brought a strange party structure. We in did. That I keep adding to my coterie.
All right. Well, that brings us then to the final question. Not on this show, right? But would you, Shane, as a player, play this adventure again, basically as it was written?
No, I wouldn't. I like it as a foundation, framing device, inspiration for a game. It is derivative, extremely so, but it's derivative in a kind of fun and nostalgic way for me because I was the right age for Harry Potter. And that, you know, have probably not engaged with Harry Potter in years. So like, you know, there's a little bit of like, of fun to kind of go back to that sort of childhood mentality. But the D&D piece of this is like, I don't need to do that again. Mm-hmm. You know, like I could be just fine without it. you want to run this in masks and I'm all in.
I mean, look, I was going to be like, I don't need to engage with this ever again. And now I'm actually kind of intrigued about the idea of running it in masks, you know? So I'm like, okay, the bull, right? Like, you're really tough. You're just very good at shield spells. Okay, all right. I could get behind this.
Well, we don't need to solve for this problem on the air, but like, I think you translate the magic in the adventure into superhero skills, right? So when you're learning the defensive other way. Stuff, you're you know, those are your strong man, tough guy, you know, like unbreakable girl type archetypes. And then when you get into like the history, that's your brainy ones that you probably got to get like the empath and telepath and like that stuff kind of, you know what I mean? But like right. You kind of map the superhero archetypes into.
So you'd rather go the other way and like make the adventure like Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters.
Bingo.
Yeah. I could see that too. I'm into that.
Yeah. Minor supervillains are terrorizing school, but whatever.
It's a trope, you know?
I do think it would be very funny. I mean, this would be like a very campy kind of like, you know, comic book world that you're living in. It certainly wouldn't fit the X-Men, but like, it would be very funny if like the administration like did bring in like retired villains to be professors, you know? Because like superheroes and villains are an economy. Like you could get your Severus Snape character in there.
I'm into it. And then, like, if you did the Tez trope, I think you just need to be a sidekick. Right, like alone and not with your...
Oh, right, a sidekick without a hero. Exactly, trying to, like, right. fake it as... Like, try to fake being a hero?
Or maybe learning to be one. Or learning right? to be a hero. On your own for the first time, right?
Right, right.
Which I guess is just Teen Titans.
Yeah. Yeah, which is in itself just masks, so it all comes back around. Well, before we wrap up, I suppose we could talk a little bit about what we have planned for season four. We don't know when it will run, but we have an idea of kind of what we're going to be doing for it. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely no idea when it will happen, because mostly these APs have been, you know, to cover us in trying moments. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the plan is everyone goes back to Sharn, and then we're going to spend a little time maybe on like smaller stories and vignettes where Tez is going to be, as foreshadowed at the end of the AP, helping people, even though he does not want to.
He's a burned rogue archaeologist.
Yeah, he's a who's on notice.
Who's landed in Sharn and is trying to get back out of the...
My name is Tez Proudgale.
Exactly. You might be asking how I got here. If you ever find yourself working for the Trust of Zalargo. so we're going to do kind of a burn notice type theme of like small little kind of local scale kind of adventures. Wrapped in this sort of broader plot of the Trust and Gulthias and all of that sort of stuff, right? So a little bit of like laying low in Sharn and making ends meet and doing a little good in our community that we're slowly building around us, right? Because we certainly have enough friends.
Little by little, yeah. Oh, you just wait. Everyone's coming out of the woodwork.
Well, I apparently got a whole goblin tribe coming out of the woodwork.
You hang up a shingle, yep. Of course, this is, maybe it's cursed in the same way that like your Pirates game is cursed, right? You for years have wanted to like run a Pirates game, and like home group has been like, yeah, we want to play in a Pirates game. And, you know, it's never quite been pulled off in that way. You've kind of had to clutch it together. And you did Rogue Trader, right?
We did Rogue Trader, yeah. Right, and this is your burn notice. You don't get to run burn notice. You get to run, if you squint, it looks like burn notice.
Both of us are very into the burn notice idea, and so it makes me think that it totally won't work. But we'll find out.
I can't wait for session three, or for episode three, for us to suddenly take a long detour to a far and distant land.
Right, now forget this. You're getting on a black plane.
We're going to Zendrick.
You got a bag over your head. You're going to wake up in a jungle.
Oh, so it's the Sam Axe spinoff.
Yes.
All right, we're talking too much about burn notice. We got to get out of here. Let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. Where you can remind us about Shatterspike.
Over and over. Absolutely.
All right. Before we wrap up, we want to take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show very shortly back to every week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/TotalPartyThrill.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
Probably about as far afield from a magical school AP as you can get. We are going to be talking about the future of RPGs. And open gaming licenses.
From magical school APs to magical school IPs.
Ooh.
All right, that's it for episode 335 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.